All right, so this is bio 241, and it is September 8th, and we're going to finish up chapter 6, move on to chapter 4 today. And don't forget, next time you have a test, right, on 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. So what's the most important thing? No, one of these guys. A good eraser, right? That doesn't smudge. And then, of course, you need a pencil. But check your eraser with your pencil on a clean white piece of paper. Make sure that it erases. This is the Scantron that you need, 882E. And it's got across in the bubbles, A, B, C, D, E. Now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the bubbles are clear. That's the easiest way for the machine to grade these things, and make sure you don't have any stray marks on this thing, and that it's not mutilated or spindled any one way or another. All right, so that's what you need. You just need one of those. And then you also need a basic scientific calculator without a memory, without a Bluetooth, without internet connection, okay, that you might be able to do some simple calculations with. And then I'll provide everything else, like maybe a periodic table, for instance, so you can find out the atomic number of something. Okay. So, any questions? Anybody have any questions? All right, so we were talking about resting membrane potential. Remember, all cells in your body act like a battery because there's something that's stuck inside all cells. They can't get out. What's stuck inside all cells? They can't get out. These anions that are proteins, right? So proteins have a very negative nature. So the inside of cells are very negative. All right. Let me get this going here. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing that helps determine the battery nature of cells is the sodium-potassium pump. Remember, it doesn't pump equal numbers of sodium and potassiums across the membrane. And when we say pump, what does that mean? Yeah, it moves sodium and potassium against their concentration gradient, and it uses an energy molecule. What's that energy molecule? ATP, right? So that's pretty much a definition of a pump. And so what is that, active transport or passive transport? It's active transport. And what kind of active transport is that? You know two different kinds. Okay, what are the two kinds? Primary and secondary. Primary uses what directly? ATP in the membrane protein, like a pump. And secondary active transport uses what as an energy source? A concentration gradient of something or another, right? It could be an electrical gradient, or it could be just a chemical gradient. If there is an electrical gradient, what do we call that? That's got a special name. If there is a difference in charge in two different places, we call that a voltage. Right, or a potential. So that's just what batteries do. They just create different amounts of positive charges and negative charges in two different places. And what can you tell me about positive and negative charges? Positive what? Attract or repel? Negative. They attract, right? So in electrical sense, opposite charges attract each other. And then since they attract each other, the concentration gradient goes away, and then the voltage goes away, and then that battery, we would say, is dead. Okay. All right, so here we see the sodium-potassium pump. Remember, it will pump into the cell two potassiums, and it will pump out three sodiums at the same time. So that adds a little bit to the resting membrane potential, since these are unequal charges being moved. So this slide right here just shows a summary of all the processes that affect the membrane potential, the resting membrane potential. All right, we can calculate the equilibrium potential due to potassium and due to sodium. All right, but if we add these two together, we see we get a resting membrane potential of about minus 30 millivolts, but that's not what we typically find. We find what? Minus 70. So there are other things going on inside the cell just besides the equilibrium potential that's developing the resting membrane potential. So these are all the things that contribute to producing a minus 70 millivolt resting membrane potential, or RMP. Well, first we got the fixed ions inside the cell, and then there are unequal permeabilities of potassium compared to sodium. And potassium is way more permeable through the cell membrane than sodium is. So that adds some negativity to the cell. Right? The sodium-potassium pump is another thing that maintains an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. All right, so that if we were to add all of these things up, that would give us a resting membrane potential typically in a normal cell of about minus 70 millivolts. Now, where is it minus 70? With respect to where? Is it negative on the inside or negative on the outside? All right, so just try to remember this little voltmeter right here, right, is going to be, this is the measurement probe, this is the ground electrode, so it's negative on the inside of the cell compared to the outside of the cell, and that's primarily due to all of these fixed anions that are inside the cell. All right, so that's RMP. So let's change our attention now to cell signaling. Let's talk about how cells communicate with each other. And I have a little bit different idea than what your book does. Right? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells is called a synapse. All right? So some say your book just calls a certain kind of synapse a synaptic transmission, but I'd lump all communication between cells as some kind of synapse. Furthermore, in my way of thinking, there are two general types of synapses in the body. There are electrical synapses, and then there are chemical synapses. Right? With an electrical synapse, there is an electrical signal that goes from one cell directly into a neighboring cell that transmits information or excites the neighboring cell. If it's a chemical synapse, an electrical signal does not move directly from one cell to another, but it has to be changed into a chemical signal, right? And that moves from one cell to another. And that chemical signal then, when it gets to the second cell, maybe changes the electrical properties of that cell, so it goes back into an electrical signal, or somehow changes the metabolism of that cell. All right, so what we see right here is our two cells. Right, and what can you tell me about where I'm circling with my pointer right here? What does that look like to you? That looks like a phospholipid bilayer, right? And that's just a simple phospholipid right here. So that's the cell membrane. That's the plasma membrane of a cell. And then here is another plasma membrane. So these two cells are separated from each other, but they have a special little junction between them, and it acts like a tunnel. So this tunnel right here is what we call a gap junction, and this tunnel is big enough because it will allow, say, a sodium ion, which has a positive charge, to move from the top cell down into the bottom cell. And when that sodium ion moves into the bottom cell down here, it changes the electrical properties of that cell. All right, so remember, what did we say RMP was? It was, yeah, resting membrane potential, but I tell you what, give me a number. What is RMP? Minus 70, right? So the inside of this cell is going to be negative, but if a sodium ion moves from the top cell into the bottom cell, what happens to the RMP in the bottom cell? If a positive charge moves in, does it change? Yeah, the voltage goes from minus 70 to minus 69, minus 68, right? It goes from something negative to positive, we call that depolarization. All right, so that sodium, as it moves through, is changing the electrical property of the cell down here on the bottom. It's depolarizing it. So this would be an example of an electrical synapse, where an electrical current in the form of sodium, all right, a sodium current, is changing the electrical properties of a neighboring cell. And that happens through a gap junction. And gap junctions are relatively rare in the body. Most are, most synapses are chemical synapses. So which type of synapse is a gap junction, where a change of electricity in one cell can change the electrical properties of a neighboring cell through this gap junction? That's an electrical synapse, right? So that's very fast. And this is typically how myocardial cells communicate with each other, or heart cells. If one heart cell depolarizes, and that signals contraction. Guess what happens to all the cells of the heart because they have gap junctions? They become excited, they all depolarize, and the whole heart then contracts as what? A unit, which is really nice. That's what's necessary for the heart to pump blood. But you wouldn't want that for skeletal muscle, right? What would it be like if one skeletal muscle depolarized, which signals contraction of one cell, say maybe your little finger, right? If there are gap junctions between all of the skeletal muscles in your body, what would happen? Yeah, your whole body would contract, right? And so you wouldn't have any coordination of skeletal muscle in your body as a result of that. So you can imagine. Do you think that there are electrical synapses or chemical synapses to skeletal muscle that excite? It's going to be a chemical synapse, right? Not an electrical. Yeah. Seizures usually are due to wild depolarizations in the brain, which then send signals down to the muscles. Okay, and that could be maybe at the level of spinal cord, or it could be the brain. But there could be damage to a muscle, for instance, like the biceps, maybe due to overuse injury or something, a chemical imbalance, and it will just contract on its own. That's what you would call a cramp. Okay, so we might find some abnormal conditions where a whole muscle might contract, but not your whole body, thank goodness. Because if your whole body went into a contraction, then of course you couldn't breathe. And then a muscle cramp would certainly be fatal if that was the case. But that's what does happen, for instance, with strychnine poisoning. Strychnine is a toxin that works on your spinal cord. So any kind of stimulus that you perceive gets sent to the spinal cord, and then your whole spinal cord is activated, and that sends out stimulatory impulses to all the muscles in your body. Okay, so that's what? Very abnormal. That's only with strychnine poisoning. Okay. As far as the kinds of molecules that can be used for signaling, so if this layer right here is going to want to send a signal to some part of your body, maybe this is a neuron right here that wants to send a signal to these smooth muscle cells right here to contract. These neurons will release a chemical, and it's going to diffuse a very short distance, and then it's going to stimulate these muscle cells down over here. In that particular case, we call that a paracrine signaling molecule because it's just going to diffuse by a very, very short distance. All right, but what do these smooth muscle cells have in order to become excited by these signaling molecules? These smooth muscle cells right here, which we call target cells, right, have to have a receptor to this particular signaling molecule. All right, so what must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? It's got to have some kind of receptor molecule. And we're going to see where there are two locations for receptor molecules. Right? And furthermore, what must be the shape of the binding site of the paracrine receptor? Right? So there's going to be a receptor on these cells that's going to be sensitive to these paracrines. But what's the relationship between this paracrine and its receptor? The shape has to be complementary. Right, so if the paracrine signaling molecule is spherical in nature, then there has to be a dimple in the receptor molecule that is what? That is basically spherical, that will allow the paracrine to bind to it. So if the receptor had a triangular shape, binding site, or a square, or conical, or something like that, then these cells right here would be blind, would not notice these signaling molecules at all. The way that information gets transmitted is by the shape of the signaling molecule has to match up to the shape of the receptor on the cell. Okay. All right, so here we have a neuron. And what does this look like down here to you? What does this cell look like here? What does it have? Is it uniform, or what do you see on it? Yeah, you see striations, right? So that could be cardiac muscle, but I don't see any intercalated disc. It's not branched. So you would say, oh, that's probably a nice skeletal muscle fiber, right? Okay, so this neuron right here, the job of this neuron is to excite this muscle cell into contracting. And the way that information is transmitted down a neuron is as an electrical signal. Right? So it uses sodium and potassium. We're going to look at that really, really soon. So it travels very fast as an electrical signal. But now here is a space between the neuron and the muscle cell. That electrical signal can't hop from the neuron into the muscle fiber. If it were to do that, then there would be like a little lightning bolt between them. And there are no such things as lightning bolts in our body. Right? Okay. So how does that electrical signal then cause this muscle cell to contract? Well, because this is what we call a chemical synapse. There's no direct connection. There's no gap junction between them. The electrical signal, when it reaches the axon terminus right here, causes the release of a chemical called a neurotransmitter. Neuro, because this is a neuron. And that signal gets transmitted to the muscle right here. And we're going to learn a number of different kinds of neurotransmitters, some special names, but does anybody know a name of a neurotransmitter? Like acetylcholine is a really good example. And that is the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction right here. Acetylcholine is released from the neuron, diffuses across this space, which we call the synaptic cleft, and binds to a receptor in the membrane of the muscle cell. And that changes the electrical properties of this muscle cell, which then initiates muscle contraction. So the way information gets transmitted is that down a neuron, the information is transmitted as an electrical signal, and that information then gets converted into a chemical signal at the synapse. And then when the neurotransmitter reaches the muscle fiber, it gets converted back into an electrical signal. So that's why we call this a chemical synapse right here, because a neurotransmitter is used to carry information across the synapse, not some kind of electrical current. So remember, information is an electrical signal in a neuron. It's a chemical signal through the synapse, and then it gets converted back to an electrical signal within the muscle cell, which causes that muscle to contract. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical. And that gives very precise control of this skeletal muscle cell right here. All right, furthermore, what must be the shape of the binding site on this muscle right here to the neurotransmitter? Let's just say that instead of being a spherical molecule, let's just say that this neurotransmitter was triangular. What would have to be the shape of the receptor? It's got to be triangular as well, right? So sometimes we invoke lock and key or hand and glove or whatever for you to realize that the shapes have to match up. And guess what happens if the shape changes? The function changes, right? And then this neuron loses its ability to communicate with this muscle cell as a result of that. So there's always structural functional relationships. Okay, another kind of signaling scheme, instead of use of a neurotransmitter or a paracrine, is with an endocrine signaling scheme. And so here we have a glandular tissue that is synthesizing and at the proper time is going to release a signaling compound. And it diffuses to a capillary. And what can you tell me about what's the functional significance of a capillary? Exchange can take place because what can you tell me about the structure of a capillary? It's very, very thin, right? It's specialized for exchange. And you should be aware of a number of different kinds of capillaries in your body, but most are leaky, right? Some are a lot more leaky than others, like fenestrated capillaries and sinusoidal capillaries are extremely leaky. But things can diffuse in and out of the blood at a capillary, as a matter of fact, at a capillary only, because veins and arteries are way too thick to allow things to move in and out or for exchange to take place. So this gland releases a hormone. It gets picked up by the blood, and then where does it go? It goes everywhere where the blood goes, which is where? Pretty much everywhere in your body, except some tendons, cartilage, for instance, epithelium. Don't have blood vessels, but pretty much everywhere in your body. And then it can diffuse out of the blood where? What kind of blood vessel will allow diffusion out? At another capillary someplace, right? And why does this hormone want to leave the blood through a capillary? Why would a hormone leave the blood? Okay. Because of, what would you use to invoke the movement of this molecule out of the blood? You would say diffusion. Okay, and how does diffusion work? It moves from high concentration to low concentration. So we have high concentration of hormone in the blood, low in the tissue, so the hormone will just move from the blood into these tissue spaces, down its concentration gradient. And this signaling molecule is going to bump into thousands of different kinds of cells, but if it is a target cell, what can you tell me about, what does this target cell have to have in order to respond to this signaling molecule? It's got to have a receptor, right? It's got to have a receptor to it. So if these cells here have a receptor to this compound that's being released by this gland, then this becomes a target tissue. And if it doesn't have a receptor, then it can't be a target tissue to that particular hormone. And again, the shape has to match up. All right, there are two different locations where receptors can be found in... So what kind of tissue has a receptor? What kind of tissue has a receptor? It's got to be a target tissue, okay? Target tissue has a receptor, and by definition, then, it becomes a target tissue. All right, so we could break down signaling molecules into hydrophilic molecules and hydrophobic molecules. Which one can move across the cell membrane, the hydrophilic or the hydrophobic? Okay. I maybe heard two answers. All right, so it's the hydrophobic molecules that can go through the plasma membrane, because remember, this interior part of the phospholipid bilayer is nonpolar. It will exclude polar molecules. So only nonpolar molecules can diffuse across it. All right, so hydrophobic regulatory molecules, right, can move into the cytoplasm. And so those kinds of molecules have a cytoplasmic receptor. All right, so you got to know that the hydrophobic kinds of molecules can get in. The receptors are cytoplasmic. And once a cytoplasmic receptor binds to a signaling molecule, it moves into the nucleus, and then it acts as a transcription factor. So what the heck does that mean? So if this complex, this cytoplasmic receptor bound to a signaling molecule, can be a transcription factor, what's that going to start? It's going to start transcription. And what is transcription? Transcription is the first step of what? Of protein synthesis, right? So this signaling molecule, when it binds to a cytoplasmic receptor, is going to start protein synthesis. And that protein then can change the activity of this cell right here once it gets translated into a protein as well. Okay, so some examples of hydrophobic regulatory molecules would be steroids, right? And you should be aware of that, because do you have a picture in your mind of what a steroid molecule looks like? Kind of has that little staircase step effect to it, and it's what? A lipid. It can go through the plasma membrane because it is hydrophobic. Other kinds that you wouldn't be familiar with at this point would be thyroid hormones and another signaling molecule called nitric oxide. These things can change activity of cells because they can act as what? Transcription factors initiating protein synthesis within the nucleus of that cell. Okay. So, if one group of signaling molecules are hydrophobic, guess what the other class of signaling molecules will be? They will be hydrophilic. And if they're hydrophilic, can they get through the phospholipid bilayer? No, they can't. So you might be wondering, how on earth does something that's stuck outside the cell change something inside the cell, the living processes inside the cell? All right, so that's where we have the second slide right here. For hydrophilic regulatory molecules, the receptor can't be inside the cell because the signaling molecule can't ever get in. So the receptor has to be in the membrane. All right, and so here we see a protein, which is a receptor, and does it look like it's going to bind this signaling molecule? Yeah, because the shape is complementary to each other. All right. So polar regulatory molecules bind to surface receptors, and then somehow or another, that's going to change the metabolism inside of the cell, and usually that can happen through what we call a second messenger. Right? That, so when the first messenger binds to the receptor, that then starts the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. So where are first messengers always located? Outside the cell. Where are second messengers always located? They're going to be inside the cell, so the first messenger doesn't have to enter the cell. It just has to bind to a receptor that's on the outside. And this is a real important process that we call signal transduction. So signal transduction will take a signal that is outside the cell in the form of a... What's the signal outside the cell called? That's the first messenger, and that will be transduced into a signal inside the cell that we call a second messenger, all right, through this little apparatus right here, which is what we call a receptor. And it's a little bit more complicated than just a receptor. So we're going to look at how these things go. So some second messengers could be, for instance, calcium ions. All right, so where are we going to find these second messengers? Inside the cell, right? So if calcium is going to be a messenger signaling a change inside the cell, what do you think the normal concentration of calcium is inside the cell when it's at rest? Would it be high or low if it's going to be used as some kind of signal? It should be normally really low, because if it's high, if the concentration changes a little bit, the cell won't recognize it, right? Okay, one way to think of that is, you know, if I came in here and I said, okay, I'm going to flash the lights, and that's going to signal that you can start to take the test, right? So I'll pass the test out, but only until you can't start taking the test until I flash the lights on and off. All right, so that would be the signal. But what happens if I were to take a spotlight and shine it in your eyes? Okay, and then I turn the lights on the room on and off. Would you see the signal? You couldn't see the signal because you have this big spotlight in your eyes, right? So in order for calcium to be a signaling molecule, the level has to be relatively low so that when it changes, the cell can notice it, right? So you should know that calcium concentration is low inside the cell and it's relatively high outside the cell, right? That's one of the things you should know for the test. Another kind of second messenger inside the cell is a molecule that's based on adenosine triphosphate, and that is adenosine monophosphate. So if we take an ATP, which has three phosphates on it, and take off two phosphates, what are we left with? We're left with just one phosphate, and a special kind of adenosine monophosphate is when it forms a cyclic ring, and we call that cyclic AMP. That's a very powerful signaling molecule inside some cells. So cyclic AMP is a signaling molecule inside some cells, but do you ever find cyclic AMP outside? We're calling it a second messenger. No, second messengers are inside, right? Cyclic AMP builds up inside the cell as a result of some first messenger outside the cell. G proteins are important second messengers. Another lipid compound is diacylglycerol, or what we just call DAG, and then inositol 3-phosphate, which I just call IPI-3. These are important second messengers that we can find running around inside the cell. And we'll see some example of these when we go through the class. Okay, so these are all important second messengers. All right, one of the most important kinds of receptor complexes that is highly conserved throughout all of biology, that means what? All living cells, right, use G proteins as a way to for signal transduction, all right? And so they're a part of a second messenger pathway in all cells, and including ours. They contain three subunits whose components dissociate when the cell surface receptor is activated. So these G protein units are associated with the plasma membrane, on the inside of the membrane. Right? And when they become activated, they dissociate from the receptor and they can diffuse around on the inside surface of the membrane and they can bump into various other proteins in the membrane. And these other proteins could be enzymes, which then can be activated or deactivated, or they can actually be a channel for, say, an ion. And when it bumps into that ion channel, it can open or close the ion channel, and then that's going to change the electrical properties of the cell. So this is what a G-protein coupled receptor looks like. All right, so what we have right here is what? The phospholipid bilayer. Don't forget, what kind of molecules, what kind of signaling molecules can't get across? The hydrophilic kind, right? So in order for that hydrophilic signaling molecule to have an effect inside the cell, it's got to have a receptor on the outside. So this is the typical G-protein coupled receptor. So here is the receptor. These three subunits right here are what we call the G-protein. All right, so here's the alpha, beta, and gamma just stands for the tail end of the G-protein. And we call it a G-protein because it's activated by a high-energy compound, which is similar to ATP, but it is actually GTP, guanosine. That's just another nucleotide. All right, so the alpha subunit can bind a GTP, and then this energy is imparted into the G-protein. All right, so now this receptor has become activated. It's become charged. So that if it binds a signaling molecule right here, something can happen. So let's go up to step number two. This regulatory molecule, right, would we call this a first messenger or a second messenger? That's the first messenger. Right? When it binds, right, this GDP is going to be released. A GTP will bind to the alpha subunit. The next thing that's going to happen is that this thing is going to come off of the receptor. And the alpha subunit is going to go one way and the beta and gamma will just go a different way. So that just means that these will dissociate. So these will can float, the beta and gamma can float around on the inside surface of the membrane and so can this alpha subunit. And these different subunits can bump into some effector kind of proteins. These effectors could be maybe an ion channel in one case. So maybe it's closed, but when the beta and gamma bump into it, it opens up and it allows maybe for sodium to rush into the cell, right? And what can you tell me about sodium? What do you know about sodium? It's a charged molecule. What kind of charge does it have? It has a positive charge, and so that's going to depolarize the cell. That's going to change the cell RMP from minus 70, and it's going to move it up to zero. It's going to make it more positive inside the cell. It's going to change the activity of the cell. All right. Or, for instance, if this alpha subunit bumps into an enzyme, that enzyme can now start to catalyze various reactions within the cytoplasm, changing the metabolism inside the cell. And then after a while, the subunits dissociate from the effector molecules. They recombine, and they also then reassociate with a receptor molecule, and that process can be stimulated over and over and over again. All right, so this regulatory molecule, don't forget, always stays outside the cell, and then these effectors change something inside the cell, so that transduces the signal of the first messenger into second messengers inside the cell. Okay, so this possibly could be an exam figure, right? So G-protein coupled receptors are real important. They're highly conserved. Basically, all cells use them to communicate with their environment and listen to signaling molecules. okay, so here is, so this right here is what we call the G-protein coupled receptor. The G-protein is what? The alpha, beta, and gamma, which is different from the receptor protein that's embedded in the membrane. Okay. All right, so that's it for chapter 6. Yeah. guanosine triphosphate. Okay? Like ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine triphosphate. All right, that's a high energy molecule, otherwise known as ATP. There is another one that isn't used quite as much in your body, but it is used nonetheless, and that is GTP. So ATP is this. GTP is guanosine triphosphate. And so it's just going to be this kind of structure. You see 1, 2, 3 phosphates. All right. And when we draw a chemical compound out with these solid lines like that, can anybody remember what does that represent? That's a chemical bond. And then how many different kinds of chemical bonds do you know? You know a bunch, at least 4. Okay, which one's the strongest kind? Covalent bond. And what's happening there with a covalent bond? Sharing of electrons. Yeah, so there are a couple of electrons right here that are being shared. So, and what kind of bond is that? Is that the weak one or the strong one? That's the strong one. So these are nice, strong covalent bonds, and when they break, that releases a lot of energy that your body can use to like contract muscle or to move ions around, to pump ions. So guanosine triphosphate is just another form of ATP. It's a high energy compound. So that answers your question? Okay. Cytosine triphosphate, uracil triphosphate, they're all sort of in the same class of compounds. But the one that's used as currency in your cell is ATP. All right, so let's move on to chapter 4, enzymes and energy. So we're going to talk about enzymes first. Okay, so enzymes are what we call biological catalysts that increase the rate of a chemical reaction. All right, so you got to know what a catalyst does. A catalyst is something that changes the rate of a chemical reaction. And a chemical reaction does what? It can take one kind of compound and convert it into another set of compounds. All right, like for instance, we have wood right here that's making up this tabletop right here. And what could we convert that wood into? Like what's happening in the Angeles Forest, National Forest right now? All that wood is being converted into carbon dioxide and water. All right, so maybe I'll just put that on the board. All right, so that's a kind of chemical reaction. All right, so if we have wood, and if it gets converted into CO2 and water, all right, that's going to release a tremendous amount of energy. All right, so that's what happens when we burn wood, for instance. And so a catalyst is something that would increase this rate of reaction. And in biology, most catalysts are proteins. And so we call them enzymes. And they act by lowering the activation energy of a compound. Like for instance, this wood has been here for a really long time, but what does that wood really want to do? It really wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water, right? But it needs some energy to get that process started. And that could be what? Like a match or something, right? And once it gets that energy, then what's going to happen to all that wood? It's just going to spontaneously turn into carbon dioxide and water and even release more energy in all those chemical bonds. Okay, and what a catalyst does is that it would allow this process to happen, all right, without that addition of energy. And so, for instance, we can get this reaction to take place at a low temperature by incorporating, oh, let's put it right here. If we were to put wood on some zinc, right, then that zinc would convert wood into carbon dioxide and water, and the zinc would not be used up as a result of that. The wood basically would burn when it would touch that metal, but at a low temperature. All right, so let's see if I can give you another analogy right here. Let's take a look at this graph of the number of reactant molecules versus energy. Right, and if we have a number of molecules sitting maybe on the in the table, making up the table right here, not all of the molecules are at the exact same energy. There's going to be a distribution of energy within a group of molecules. And let's just say that at room temperature, right, only a very, very small number of them have enough energy to proceed to products. So let's look at the bottom graph right here. Right? Here we have a diagram of energy and versus time, basically. Right? So here we have a non-catalyzed reaction. So here are some reactants that are at high energy. You could consider this a block of wood, and it wants to go to a lower energy form, for instance, like carbon dioxide and water. But how many of these wood molecules right here have enough energy associated with them to hop over this energy barrier? Okay, only this very, very small amount right here. All right, and in the wood that's making up our desktops, this portion is what? Just minuscule small. There's hardly any molecules that have enough energy to hop over this energy barrier to move to carbon dioxide and water. All right, but now if we have an enzyme or a catalyst, right, it lowers the activation energy barrier. Look at the height of this energy barrier right here compared to the first case. It is what? It's a little bit lower. But what about the difference in energy from beginning to end? What's the beginning energy level? It's basically the same, and the final energy level is the same. The only thing that changes is this activation energy. All right, so what a catalyst does is that increases the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to get over this activation energy barrier, okay, to proceed to become products. So another way that I think of this, all right, let's think of this illustration right here. Here we have a hill, and let's just say here I have my car, all right? And if I get my, if I'm going to move my car up the hill, is that an active process or a passive process? Active. It needs gasoline, right? Okay. Now what happens if I have my car on top of the hill like this? Is that active or passive? That's a passive process. So my car wants to roll down the hill, right? And the car that I had when I was in college, I had to park on the top of a hill all the time. Why is that? Because sometimes my battery would be dead or the starter motor wouldn't work, right? It was just a little MGB, so I could just give it a little push. It would start to roll down the hill, pop the clutch, and start the car, and I could get home. Okay. So my car wants to roll down the hill over here, but let's just say that if I didn't want it to roll down the hill, I could put a piece of wood or a block by the tire. Right? So does my car want to roll down the hill? Yes. It still wants to roll down the hill, but can it?
No,
because of this block right here. This thing is acting like an activation energy barrier. Right? And so in order for my car to roll down the hill, right, one thing we could do is, for instance, if I could call a friend maybe with a big bus or something or a big truck, right, and then it could hit my car from behind, and then what would happen? my car would bump over that activation energy barrier and then start to roll down the hill. All right, so that's one way of getting my car to go down the hill. But there's a more sophisticated way. What's a better way? You could just move this block out of the way, right? And then just give it a really light push, and the car is going to roll down the hill. So that's what a catalyst does. A catalyst just removes the block so that a reaction can proceed if it has that natural tendency to proceed. So that's what a catalyst does. The other thing about a catalyst is that it never gets used up during a reaction. It can be used over and over and over and over again. And an enzyme is a biological catalyst that is what? Made out of a protein. Okay, so what does a catalyst do? That's something I want you to know. What does an enzyme or a catalyst do? First, it what? It speeds up what? It speeds up our reaction. All right. And number two, how does it speed up a reaction? By decreasing activation energy. All right, it doesn't change the beginning energy and the ending energy of the products and reactants. It just changes the activation energy. All right, so enzymes do that by changing the structure of something. All right, so enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape, which we call a conformation. Right, it has a tertiary structure, and it has little pockets or sulci or grooves, which we call active sites, into which the substrates fit. All right, so for a chemical reaction, usually we have something called reactants that get converted into products. All right, but for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, we change this around a little bit. We have substrates that get converted into products. So we kind of change the term reactants into substrates for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. All right, and the substrates have to bind to the enzyme at this active site over here. And again, we always invoke the lock and key model to describe why a particular substrate might want to bind to an enzyme. It has to be by shape, right? So that the shape of the active site on an enzyme is complementary to the shape of a substrate. All right, and so then the enzymes act by bringing substrates close together so that they can react. So here is a real important diagram, probably an exam figure, of the way that you should think of an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. So here you have a big protein molecule, which is an enzyme, and you can see a couple of dimples in it right here. These are what we call the active sites. And this one right here has the right shape where it can bind substrate A. This is the active site that can bind substrate B. And when these two molecules bump into each other and it binds the substrates, look what happens to substrate A and B. They bump into each other, right? And now this chemical reaction can take place between them, and they form products. And then they're released from the enzyme right here. All right, so what is the difference between the enzyme that I have on the right side compared to the enzyme over here way on the left? Can you see a difference? No. What's the color? Exactly the same. What about the shape? Exactly the same. So that's something important to know about enzyme-catalyzed reactions. All right, that's always a good trick question, right? And that is, there is no difference between these enzymes. The enzyme does not get changed during the chemical reaction. And as a matter of fact, it can catalyze another reaction over and over and over again. All right, so what does get used up during an enzyme-catalyzed reaction? The substrates get used up, and what builds up? The products build up, right? But the enzyme just stays the same. The enzyme concentration does not change. Okay. So for an enzyme catalyzed reaction, you should, say substrates over here going to products. So there has to be this intermediate form, which we call the enzyme substrate complex, that has to form before products can form. All right, so if the conformation of this enzyme changes, maybe due to temperature or pH or salt concentration, right, and then the shape of the active site for substrate A changes, guess what can't happen? Then substrate A can't bind to the active site, the enzyme substrate complex can't form, and if the enzyme substrate complex can't form, what about product formation? Then no products are formed as a result of that. All right, so enzyme substrate complex is necessary to develop before products are formed. All right, so what's another way of thinking about how an enzyme does its job by reducing the activation energy? Let's look at these two markers that I have right here. Okay. And so I have a couple molecules right here. Let's just say that these are the reactants, and they can join together and form a product, which is just like this. This is a product. All right, so we see that they fit together just right to form a product. And these things are always in motion. Right? What happens to the motion of these two molecules as the temperature increases? Then the motion of these things increase as well, right? All right, and since they're moving, they're going to bump into each other every once in a while. If they bump into each other like this, will a product form? No. If they bump into each other like this, will a product form? Or like this? Or like this? Or like that? Okay, or like this? All right, how many different ways can I have these two markers bump into each other to not form a product? Oh yeah, millions of different ways, right? But if I increase the temperature, what happens to the probability that they will bump into each other just the right way to form a product? Right, as the temperature increases, then they have more probability because they bump into each other more often. Okay, well, here's the beauty of an enzyme. An enzyme will grab these two molecules because of the active site, and when they are bound to the active site, it shoves these two molecules together precisely so that the chemical reaction can take place. Right? On the surface of the enzyme, these two molecules can't bump into each other any other way than what? That one exact way that they have to touch each other to form a product. All right, so that's the job of an enzyme. It reduces the activation energy barrier by making sure that the substrates touch each other in just the right orientation to form a product. Right? So, and that prevents what? A lot of futile bumping into each other in ways that won't produce a reaction. All right, so what else can we say about enzymes? Well, they got to have the right shape in order to bind substrates. They work faster as the temperature increases. All right, but what happens if the temperature is too hot? What's going to happen to the protein? It's going to denature. It's going to change shape drastically, and then the active site is destroyed. And if the active site is destroyed, what can't form? The enzyme substrate complex can't form, and therefore the products aren't going to form as a result of that. All right, but the shape of these active sites is also dependent on salt concentration and pH. Right, so that's why all enzymes have an optimal activity depending on a particular pH and salt concentration and even temperature. All right, so let's talk about how we name enzymes. Most enzymes, at least with modern nomenclature, have an ASE on the end of the word. And usually we name an enzyme by its particular substrate and then add an ASE, and then we know exactly what its activity is. So, for instance, there might be an enzyme that works on sugar, lactose. So here's a sugar, lactose. We know that's a sugar because there's an OSC on the end of that word right here. And there might be an enzyme that breaks lactose down. Guess what the name of that one would be called? That would be lactase. All right, so that's, and we could say lipase. What does lipase work on? It breaks down lipids, for instance, or a protease is an enzyme that breaks down proteins. All right, so here are a couple other real important ones. A phosphatase removes a phosphate from a molecule. So let's just say we have a really big molecule right here that has a phosphate group on it, and then we're going to end up with a different molecule plus a phosphate over here. The enzyme that catalyzes this reaction is a phosphatase. Okay, that's a phosphatase. And when this big phosphate comes off of this protein molecule over here, guess what happens to the shape of this protein? It changes. This phosphate is a really big functional group. It's like a finger poking you in the side, and when you remove that finger, right, it changes, that drastically changes the conformation of this protein. Right, so when the shape changes of this protein right here, what else changes? The function is going to change. Okay, so a phosphatase is in this direction, but we could also have an enzyme that takes, say, maybe ATP and this protein, and it takes a phosphate from ATP and puts it on the protein. This is what we call a kinase. And that's going to cause a change in conformation of the protein again. And if the structure changes, what about the activity of this protein? It's going to change as well. Okay. So phosphatase takes off a phosphate, a kinase puts one on. And that changes the activity of that particular enzyme. Okay, lactate dehydrogenase. Tell me something about lactate dehydrogenase. What's the substrate that it works on? Would be lactate, and lactate is just another name for lactic acid. Lactic acid and lactate are the same, and it's going to take off a hydrogen atom. Okay, here are some important enzymes. Catalase, all right, takes H2O2 and converts it into water and oxygen. And I'm going to spend just a little bit of time with this one because it's pretty easy to see. Does anybody know what H2O2 is? H2O2? That is, for every oxygen, there is a hydrogen. So we call that hydrogen peroxide. And where do you have that? Have you ever heard of hydrogen peroxide? Right? You keep it in a bottle, maybe in a medicine cabinet. What kind of bottle is it in? Yeah, really, really dark. Okay? Because hydrogen peroxide all by itself wants to degrade and get converted into water and oxygen. It just automatically wants to convert to water and oxygen so that if you've had hydrogen peroxide in a bottle, even though it's in a dark bottle in a dark part of a closet or medicine cabinet, after about 20 years, you're not going to have any hydrogen peroxide in there at all. It's just going to be water and oxygen. Okay? So that will automatically happen. But if you buy some fresh hydrogen peroxide, right, and you put some on the table right here, all right, are you going to notice any rapid change? Not really, right? But in 20 years, if it doesn't evaporate, it's all going to be what? Water right there. But if you have a cut and you put hydrogen peroxide on that cut, what's going to immediately happen? It's going to bubble, and what are those bubbles? That's oxygen, okay, and then water is going to be formed there as well, so that's going to irrigate the wound, that's going to clean the wound out a little bit, and that oxygen is going to, that's very toxic to many bacteria, so it's going to kill bacteria, so that's a nice way of cleaning a wound out, killing bacteria that are in there, so that's used for lacerations and things like that. But why is it that it bubbles right away when you put it on a wound? Because in your body you have an enzyme called catalase. And it's going to, what is catalase going to do to this reaction right here? What does an enzyme do? It speeds up the rate of a reaction. And how does it do that? By decreasing the activation energy, right? So hydrogen peroxide automatically will be converted, but in the presence of an enzyme, it's going to be what? Lightning fast as a result of that. Okay, another enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, can act sort of similarly. It can take carbon dioxide and water. And are you familiar with carbon dioxide? Yeah, you should be really familiar with it, because what are we doing all the time? Yeah, we're producing carbon dioxide all the time. Somebody's going to figure out how to tax that really soon, right? A breath tax. Okay, everybody's talking about taxing CO2 emissions, but we produce CO2 all the time, right, with our normal metabolism. CO2 can combine with water to form carbonic acid. This happens in our body all the time, and so there is an enzyme that speeds this reaction up. And what is that enzyme called? That is carbonic anhydrase. All right, so as a matter of fact, the CO2 forms this acid. So CO2 you could think of as being a very acidic kind of compound. And when we breathe CO2 out of our body, what are we really breathing out of our body? Not only CO2, but because of this reaction right here, we're breathing carbonic acid out of our body. So our breath is actually very acidic as a result of that. So we're going to look and see how carbonic anhydrase helps regulate acid-base balance in our bodies a little bit later on in the semester. All right, but that's probably something that you'll have to know, not for the test this week, but the next test. Carbonic anhydrase interconverts carbonic acid and CO2. Amylase is an enzyme that breaks down starch. Okay, so here I see starch plus H2O going to maltose. Starch, the basic building block of starch, is glucose. Maltose is a disaccharide of two glucoses. What kind of reaction does this look like to you? That looks like a hydrolysis reaction, right? Where that water is used to, it's split apart, and then it's used to split starch down into a smaller molecule, namely this maltose. Yeah. So make sure you see you can see a dehydration synthesis reaction versus a hydrolysis reaction. Right? So amylase uses a hydrolysis reaction. What about this one right here? RNA plus water being broken down to ribonucleotides. What kind of reaction does that look like? Look at this. Starch and water going to maltose, RNA plus water going to ribonucleotides. That's a hydrolysis reaction as well, right? Breaking down RNA. Yeah, so that's a hydrolysis reaction as well. Okay. Enzyme activity is just the rate its substrates are converted into products. And we can measure the buildup of products or the breakdown of substrates over time, and that would give us the enzyme activity. And we can see that enzyme activity increases as temperature increases because molecular motion increases. But look, right around 40 degrees, guess what happens? Denaturation of a protein or that enzyme. The active site is changed, and the enzyme activity plummets as a result of that. And all enzymes have an optimal temperature, pH, and salt concentration. So here we see that for pepsin, it has an optimal pH of about 2. And you could tell me where you would expect to find pepsin operating. Where in your body would you have an environment at about between 1 and 2? In your stomach, right? And so pepsin indeed is a protease that works in the stomach. All right, trypsin, right, has an optimum around pH 9 to 10. Does anybody know what part of your body has a very basic environment? All right, the stomach is very acidic, but the small intestine is very basic. All right, so trypsin is a protease that works in the small intestine. And salivary amylase. What does amylase do again? What does it do? It breaks starch down, right? So if you eat a cracker or some pasta or something, that's being broken down into maltose right away as soon as you start chewing. And what is the pH optimum for salivary amylase? That is the enzyme that breaks down starch in your mouth, right? It's in saliva. And the pH of your mouth is not very acidic. It's not very basic. It's what? It's neutral. All right, so salivary amylase works at a pH of 7. Okay, so let's see. What did we look at here? A phosphatase. What does a phosphatase do? Removes a phosphate group. So here's an acid phosphatase. Right, works at an acid environment. Here's an alkaline phosphatase. What does it do? It, of any phosphatase, removes a phosphate group. But this one works at, what, an alkaline pH. Okay, so you can probably just look at a couple of these different enzymes to see how they work. All right, but what I want to do now is probably start here next time. But what I want to do right now is probably do the chemistry flash quiz, okay? Because you'll probably see some of these chemical compounds on the test. Oh, here we go. Sign it fast. And pass it around. Okay, plenty of time. All right, so remind me to start here next week at this time. So when you're done with the test on Thursday, there won't be a lecture afterwards, right? So you get an hour and a half to take the test. So no lecture. All right, so did I show you the flash quiz before in here? I'm sure, right? Ah, here it is. All right, so now don't forget, you guys, you're going to have to pay attention to this stuff. So at home, I don't know what you want to do. Maybe turn your monitor upside down or something so that you can even see how these things are different if they're upside down. All right, so just don't memorize the picture, but try to get a feel for why these molecules look different. All right, so what do we got going here? Yeah, triglyceride formation, right? So here's glycerol, and here are three fatty acids. And so what's the name of this reaction? This would be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay? All right, next one. That is a monosaccharide. Just a monosaccharide. This would be an example of fructose. You don't have to tell me that, but it's a six-carbon sugar. It's a very common kind of sugar in our body. And this thing, that's a micelle. More important, what is this guy here? That's a phospholipid. What part is this one? That's the hydrophilic part, right? That's the head group or the phosphate group. And then here are the two fatty acids. This is the hydrophobic region. So because this is charged, it likes to be around water molecules. All right, so that's a nice micelle. What are these? Yeah, cholesterol and some steroids. These are examples of what? Sugars, proteins, lipids, or nucleotides? Lipids, yeah, it's a lipid molecule. And from our lecture today, some of these are signaling molecules. Since they are hydrophobic, where is their receptor? Where is their receptor at? It can go through the cell membrane, so the receptors are going to be in the cytoplasm. So these all would have cytoplasmic receptors, right? So these would have cytoplasmic receptors. They're going to act as transcription factors. They're going to initiate transcription. All right, next one. Unsaturated fatty acid. So could you see fatty acid? So this is just a hydrocarbon, right? That's just a lipid, but here is what? Our carboxyl group, that's the acid group, so fatty acid. Aha, what's that? Amino acid. That's just the building block of all proteins, but this R group changes depending on what amino acid it is. How many different kinds of amino acids are there? Yeah, there's about 20 different kinds when that changes. All right, what was that? Yeah, phospholipid. Here's the phosphate group on this phosphatidyl group, and here are two fatty acids. So what can you tell? What's amazing about this molecule? What's its nature? Is it basically hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It's both. Yeah, it's a pretty cool molecule. It's got both natures. All right, what are these? Prostaglandins. They're just a modified fatty acid. What is this? This is what? Alpha helix, but what is alpha helix? It's secondary structure. What's the building block for secondary structure? primary structure, and that's just the sequence of amino acids in a protein. All right, and the secondary structure is a building block of what? The tertiary structure, right? The three-dimensional overall shape of a protein. Ooh, too fast. What was that? Okay, I see a base, I see a sugar and a phosphate. This is a nucleotide. What kind of nucleotide? It's missing an oxygen right here. This is a deoxy, and this is a ribo sugar, so it's a deoxyribonucleotide. Deoxyribonucleotide. What's it used to make? DNA, right? Deoxyribonucleotide. And functional group? Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid once again. Carbonyl group. It's a nucleotide, but what kind? Yeah, it's not deoxy because the oxygen is there. That's a ribonucleotide for making RNA. Sulfhydryl group. That's used to form very strong covalent bonds between distant segments of a protein. Okay, to give that protein a lot of stability. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Yeah, so whenever I say phosphate in here, it's really what? This inorganic phosphate that has all of these oxygens and these two hydrogens right here. So ATP would have three of these groups bound together. Right? And how would you bind these phosphate groups together? If there's another phosphate group. Look, here's an OH. There would be another OH over here. It would form by dehydration synthesis reaction. That's another monosaccharide. It's a monosaccharide. It's a 6-carbon sugar. This would be a good example of, say, glucose, for instance. Glucose. And then a saturated fatty acid. And here we have triglyceride formation. Did we go over all of them already? Wow. Okay. We'll be able to do it a couple times now. Yeah. Nope. Just tell me that it's a monosaccharide. And if we put two of them together, we get a disaccharide. Put thousands of them together, we get polysaccharide. Can you give me an example? But here's a good thing to know. What's an example of a polysaccharide? Starch. The storage form of glucose in our bodies is glycogen. It's not really starch because we're not plants. Plants, it's starch, okay, but it's the basic building block is glucose. All right, let's take a look at this. Oh, that was a monosaccharide. Micelle. Steroid. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Alpha helix or secondary structure, and you should know the building blocks going up or down one way or the other. Deoxyribonucleotide. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl. Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl. Amino, carboxyl, phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation, monosaccharide, micelle, steroid, unsaturated fatty acid, amino acid, phospholipid, prostaglandin, alpha helix, deoxyribonucleotide, hydroxyl group, glycerol, phospholipid, carbonyl, ribonucleotide, sulfhydryl, amino, carboxyl, phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation. Monosaccharide. All right, so we got a couple minutes if somebody has some questions. Anybody have? Yes. The exam. You need a pencil, number two. And you need a good eraser like this one right here. With your pencil, make a mark on a clean piece of paper. Erase it with your eraser, and if it smudges, throw your eraser away right away. Okay? Because it's going to cost you points on the test. And then you need the Scantron 882E. Between 50 and 100. So, maybe not quite 100. You know, more the better, actually, for you guys. There's going to be some figures. Yeah, because if there's 100 questions, you can miss 10. If there's only 50, you're going to be really bored if you got to stay in class the whole time because you'll answer 50, but you can only miss 5 for an A. And then a basic scientific calculator. Okay, let's go over this. Most important, eraser, pencil, 882E, basic scientific calculator, and a picture ID, either Fullerton College or Cypress College picture ID. If you do not have one of those two, I'll let you turn the test in, but you have to produce one of those two IDs for me later on in the semester. So that's not a good reason why you can't take the test on Thursdays, because you lost your ID.
You need to
show
me the ID.
Huh?
I need to show you my ID when I turn it in.
Yeah, when you turn it in, show me your ID. Yeah, because for my online classes, I have to do that so I know who the students are. And so if I do that for one group of students, guess what? Everybody, I got to treat everybody the same. Yeah. Exam figures is about 40%, I think, usually. It's going to be about the same as in anatomy, about something like that. Yeah.
So some matching there?